So this is the first of two lectures on company financing. Another way of saying that is, how do companies raise finance? Raise finance for capital investment. If you've been following the newspapers in the recent past, and in particular the financial press, you can't possibly have failed to be aware that there was a credit crunch a couple of years back. And that had a significant effect on how companies could raise finance for capital investment. In particular, as a result of the credit crunch, banks were much less keen to lend companies significant amounts of money. And that begs the question, where would the companies go then to raise that finance if it was difficult to raise money in the form of bank loans? So my starting point in this lecture is to look at the sources of financing open to a company. Thus far in this module, our focus of attention has been on the uses of the financing. We've looked at the assets that the company can invest in. We've looked at the projects in which the company would use those assets productively to add value. Now we're switching our focus. We're looking at the other side of the coin. We're looking at where does the financing come from in the first place. And what I want to introduce you to in this slide is something known as the pecking order hypothesis. Now you'll learn more about the pecking order hypothesis next year when you go on to do IB 236 Finance 2 next spring. But I want to introduce it to you. The pecking order hypothesis is due to a famous finance academic called Stuart Myers, who first published on this subject in 1984. So what is this hypothesis? Well, it classifies the typical order in which companies raise finance. First recourse is to internal funds, which you and I can now recognise as retained earnings. So the surplus funds that are available to the company from the inside, that's the first port of call when the company needs financing for new investments. But that begs the question, what does the company do when it starts to run out of internal sources of financing? Well, surprise, surprise, it looks outside of itself. It looks at external sources. The hierarchy that Myers proposes continues in the following way. It's not just any old order. Instead, companies typically go for debt financing first, and only as a last resort do they go for additional equity. I can be more specific than that. I can look more closely at the debt financing that the company may raise from outside and tell you that typically its preference is to go first for bank loans. Only when that dries up or becomes difficult, e.g. in the credit crunch that beset us in recent years, only then typically does the company go to the capital markets to raise new debt. In other words, issuing corporate bonds. So the hierarchy that Myers poses refers to the typical order in which the company seeks additional sources of financing. First, it's internal financing, its own retained earnings. And incidentally, in case you're not clear on this, retained earnings count as equity. Retained earnings contribute to the equity of the firm. When the retained earnings are all but exhausted, so the internal sources of funding have dried up, the company has to look out of itself, and typically its first port of call is debt, not additional equity. And in terms of that debt, it typically goes first to the bank for a bank loan. If that fails or that's not possible, then it turns its attention to the capital markets, the debt capital markets, where corporate bonds are raised. So these are borrowing instruments. The company issues some form of paper, a bond, in return for which it receives the sum of money that it needs, but it's in the form of a loan. When that has been exhausted, When that's proving difficult, then finally, as a last resort, the company issues additional equity finance. In other words, it issues additional shares. It creates additional shares which it makes available for purchase. And the cash it raises in that way is the form of financing that it uses. I've listed on the slide, it's taken from a textbook by Glenn Arnold, and I've highlighted the date of publication, not because I'm so hung up about that, but because I want to stress to you that the summary information I've taken from the book predates the credit crunch. So when you look at the descriptive statistics that are on the slide, you see Arnold telling us that, in general, bank loans account for about 30% of financing in the UK. That was pre-credit crunch. Those bank loans all but dried up during the period of the credit crunch. So that's my description of Myers's pecking order hypothesis. And Myers's pecking order hypothesis is informed by empirical observation. In other words, he studied a large number of companies to see what was their typical behaviour in an attempt to extract general features. Could he summarise? So I want you to understand that first and foremost, the observations I've made, the description I've given you of the Myers pecking order hypothesis, reflects what we observe companies generally do. But that's not good enough for our purposes. We want to try and understand why that might be the case. So at least I want to attempt a story or two. And you'll build on that story. Indeed, you'll go some considerable way further next year in finance too. But I want to sketch out the story. I want to suggest to you that there are two key considerations. And one is the costs associated with raising new finance. Now, there are no such costs to worry about when the financing is internal. But as soon as the company has to look outside of itself to raise additional financing, it starts to incur costs. And one suggestion I'd like to make to you is, one reason for the order that's captured in the hierarchy, debt, then equity, is that the costs associated with raising debt finance are generally lower than they are in raising additional equity. So less of the money, less of the financing that's raised, is consumed in third-party costs. If you go outside of yourself to raise either debt or equity financing, other players become involved. There's a market involved. So there are fees associated with raising that capital on the market. There will be teams of advisors to help you, and they levy fees. So these issue costs, we might term them transactions costs, these are an important drain on the financing that the company is raising. Some of it is burned off. It's consumed. This is an example of what we might term a market friction. Some of the capital that the company wants to raise for capital investment purposes never reaches the company. It's consumed in the form of third-party fees. So one suggestion is the pecking order is in the order debt, then equity, because the issue costs are typically less when it's debt than when it's equity. When we're looking at issuing additional equity through the stock market, there's any number of different costs that kick in. I've already mentioned the advisors, the stock market fund fees, the stamp duty that's attached. The company has to produce a very glossy, detailed prospectus. And in the UK, it has to send out that prospectus to all of its existing shareholders. That all costs money. The production of the prospectus and the mailing costs. So one suggestion to explain this observed hierarchy is the size of the costs. Now, we can go further with that. Because in general, these issue costs have two components. There's a fixed component, by which I mean it doesn't get bigger or smaller depending on the size of the amount of money that's being raised. And there's a variable component which goes up and down depending on how much additional capital is being raised.
Now this
is a consideration, an important consideration, for small companies. Small companies are going to be impacted more by the fixed component of these issue costs. Because they're the same size for small companies and large companies, but large companies can absorb these fixed issue costs more easily. So we shouldn't be surprised to find that small companies are much less prevalent. We don't see so much evidence of small firms going out to the capital markets to raise finance. Why? Because the issue costs have two components, and the fixed cost, which doesn't scale up or down with the size of the amount of money being raised, really hits hard when it's a small company. So small companies, when they need additional financing, external financing, they'll go off to the bank. They'll want bank loans. They'll want to avoid the capital markets. Not so the larger companies. So that's one possible explanation. But there's another quite distinct one. And that has to do with the amount of information, commercially sensitive information, that the company has to reveal as part of raising this finance. Now, if the funds are internal, the company doesn't have to say anything to the outside world because it's its own money and it can do what it wants with it. It doesn't have to make a case to anyone on the outside world to put up the money. But as soon as the company looks outside of itself, it has to start to reveal some of the commercially sensitive information in order to raise that money. It has to explain to the bank manager what is it going to use the money for. It has to produce a business plan. Fine. That's the nature of the game. But when the company goes to the capital markets, it's subject to further disclosure of information requirements. And those disclosure of information requirements hit hardest, they're most stringent, in the equity capital markets, the stock markets. So the second reason I would suggest to you for the observed hierarchy, internal funds, then external funds, and within that second grouping of external funds, debt, then equity, is the further along that line you look, the more commercially sensitive information the company has to reveal because of the rules and regulations of the capital markets. And the stock markets are the most demanding. They insist on the highest level of scrutiny. So, in summary, Stuart Myers has suggested to us that empirical observation of how companies, now Myers being a US academic, his initial observations will have been for US firms, but the story we believe replicates itself in other domiciles. Myers is telling us that on the basis of considerable empirical observation, companies seem to follow the following pattern. Internal funding first, then external funding. Within the external funding grouping, debt, then equity. And within the debt class, bank loans, then debt capital markets, securities. That's the empirical observation. And I've suggested to you two possible explanations. One, the size of the issue costs associated with each of these sources of financing. I'm suggesting to you that the hierarchy might reflect increasing issue costs. A second quite distinct explanation is how much commercially sensitive information does the company have to reveal? How much of its hand does it have to reveal to the outside world? So that's what I want you to know in terms of the pecking order hypothesis. So hopefully you've picked up from that little explanation that the capital markets are an important source of financing for companies. But they do more than that. And I mentioned in an earlier lecture how the capital markets play the role of a dating agency. They bring together sources of financing with institutions, organisations that need that financing. So here's another benefit that the capital markets provide. The company doesn't have to locate the source of the financing. It can raise the financing through the capital markets, and the capital markets will do the work for it. Of course, that's why the capital markets are levying fees. So what the markets are doing is they're bringing together sources of financing. Now, what might those sources of financing be? This might be investment funds. This might be money that's available for financial market investments in the form of corporate bonds or shares in companies. Where's this money coming from? This is money that's been invested in an investment fund, possibly a pension fund, possibly through a life assurance company. These are big players in the world of the capital markets, especially the world of the equity markets. And what the capital markets are doing is they're bringing those sources of surplus capital into contact with firms, organisations that need that capital. So they're providing a useful service there to the companies that need the funding. I want you to be aware of an important distinction. I want you to be clear about the difference between a primary market and a secondary market. A primary market, it could be debt, it could be equity. A primary market is where the securities are issued for the first time. They're born in the primary markets. So you might come across the terminology IPO, initial public offering. This is an initial offering of shares in a company to the investing public, the general public, for want of a better word. That general public will be individuals like you and me, but it'll also be large organisations. So you might come across the term IPO, initial public offering. Initial public offerings take place in the primary market. That's where the securities are created, brought into life for the first time. The secondary market is where existing securities can trade hands. So what's happening in the secondary market is not, there isn't any new capital being created, the ownership of the existing securities is changing. There's buying and selling of existing shares in companies, there's buying and selling of bonds. Now in our context, those bonds are corporate bonds because the borrower is a company wishing to raise finance. But the borrower could equally well be a government. The government also needs to borrow large sums of money because if it doesn't borrow, it has to tax. And there may be political reasons why it doesn't want to increase the rate of tax, be that income tax or capital gains tax. So in the secondary market, maybe this helps you understand and remember it, in the secondary market, second-hand securities are being bought and sold. We're not buying brand new securities for the first time. We're buying securities that someone else previously owned. The existence of an active secondary market is a necessary condition for the primary market to work in the first place. Because one of the roles of the secondary market is to provide an exit clause. Whoever put up the capital in the first place may not wish their capital to remain invested indefinitely or for the long term. They might want out. They might want to sell on their financial investment to someone else. And it's the secondary market that enables them to do that. If there wasn't an active secondary market, these sources of the initial financing, they would be more reluctant to put up the money in the first place. So it would be much harder for companies to raise the financing in the first place. So I want you to understand that the primary and the secondary markets are intimately linked. The primary market relies on the secondary market for its success. And the other thing I want you to understand is they're in the same place. They're in the same building. So the London Stock Exchange can be acting as a primary market if there's an initial public offering. At the same time, the London Stock Exchange is acting on a day-by-day basis as a secondary market where existing shares, and indeed bonds, are being bought and sold every day. So don't think of them as being in physically remote locations from one another. It's two different functions of the same market. We're going to spend most of tomorrow's lecture looking at a particular method whereby companies in the UK raise additional equity financing. That's called a rights issue, and you've got to know what a rights issue is. There are questions in next week's seminar, for instance, about the rights issue method. So most of what we'll talk about in tomorrow's lecture will be about the rights issue method. And in the UK, a company that already has shareholders, so there is existing equity in this company, it has shares that trade on the stock market, if that company wants to raise significant amounts of additional equity, it must do it by a rights issue. That's the rules. When I say significant, I mean 5% or more of its existing equity capital. So we've got to know about rights issues. The rights issue is an example of what's called a seasoned equity offering. A few minutes ago, I mentioned initial public offerings. That's where the securities, the shares in the company, typically, are issued for the first time. A seasoned equity offering is where we introduce into the market additional units of the same shares. So we create additional shares in order to raise money, but there are already those shares, the same shares, trading in the market. That's called a seasoned equity offering. Seasoned equity means there is already that equity in the market. We're just creating more units of it. And the rights issue is an example of one method for having a seasoned equity offering. In other jurisdictions, not the UK, there are other methods. Open issue. Placement. In the UK, we don't use the terminology placement. We use the terminology placing. So, as is quite often the case in finance, the US and the UK have slightly different words, sometimes very different words, for the same thing. In the UK, any significant amounts of additional equity capital has to be raised by a rights issue, not so the US. There are no such restrictions in the UK on raising debt capital. So the placing method is important in the UK, but for raising debt, not equity. So these are things that I would like you just to have some familiarity with, and you'll learn more about them, as I say, in next year's module, Finance 2. I'd like you also to have some awareness of how markets are evolving. There have been big changes in the financial markets over the last 25 years, and it would be good just to have some awareness of that. So what are the key changes that have been happening in recent years? Well, one important change has been the move away from what was typically called open outcry trading. And that's where men, and they were mostly men in coloured jackets, stood in a trading pit and shouted and screamed numbers at each other. And the numbers they shouted and screamed at each other were prices at which they were willing to buy or sell particular securities, and the quantities. How many of such and such a security, shares in a particular company, for instance, and at what price? That's called open outcry trading. And open outcry trading disappeared, as far as the stock market was concerned, in the UK in 1986. Almost certainly you'll have heard of Big Bang. So one development, one important change in regards to how the financial markets function, is the move away from open outcry. That was the method for price discovery, shouting at each other, just like a day at the races. The move away from open outcry towards electronic screen-based trading. Now, I don't think anyone could deny the speed-up implied by that change. It's faster. I don't think anyone could deny the move towards globalization, the nature, the 24/7 nature of trading. But it remains a moot point whether the trading is more transparent. In other words, how good a feel do the participants have for why the price is what it is? There are traders still active today who would argue it was more transparent in the old days when we could shout at one another in the trading pit. So speed up, no question. Globalization, the presence of information 24/7 round the globe, trading follows the sun, no arguments. But transparency, that's a moot point. Another development in the past 2 to 3 decades has been increasing competition amongst financial markets. They're chasing after the same business. They're doing the same sorts of things. And one way in which that has shown up, revealed itself, is in terms of mergers or strategic alliances. As financial markets have sought to link up with either financial markets that do different activities, but in the same country, or financial markets that do the same sort of thing, but in different countries. In other words, they've either tried to spread their geographical reach by linking up, either through a formal merger or a less formal strategic alliance. So it's either been a coming together of the same sort of financial market in different countries, like the US and Europe or the UK, or it's been the coming together of different sorts of markets. What do I mean by that? A stock market, where you buy and sell shares, and a derivatives market, where what's being traded are more sophisticated instruments like forwards and futures. Well, not forwards, in fact, they're not exchange traded. Futures contracts, options contracts, etc., etc. So it would also be helpful, I think, if you had some awareness, perhaps if you knew of some important examples where financial markets have either entered into a formal merger or have at least entered into a strategic alliance. And I've listed on the slide some of the important ones. The New York Stock Exchange, the largest stock market in the world, linking up with Euronext. Who or what was Euronext? Euronext was itself an amalgamation of stock markets in the following countries: Belgium, so the Brussels market, the Netherlands, Amsterdam, Paris, French market, Lisbon, Portuguese market. So there was Euronext, so Western European stock markets, but not London, of course. But there's an additional interesting feature, because before the New York Stock Exchange linked up with Euronext, Euronext had already taken over LIFFE, L-I-F-F-E. That's the London International Financial Forward Futures and Options Exchange. In other words, Euronext, which was itself an amalgamation of Western European continental stock markets, itself took over a large derivatives exchange. So why might the New York Stock Exchange be interested in linking up with Euronext? Two reasons. First and foremost, opening up its geographical reach, giving it a foothold in Western Europe. But secondly, expanding its activities from the cash markets, that's a market like the stock market, to include the derivatives markets. So that's a key example. Another key example is this one. The coming together of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and the Chicago Board of Options Trading. Not much geographical reach there, because they're both in the same city. They're just on opposite sides of the Chicago River. Why are they doing this? To make themselves the biggest derivatives exchange, the biggest derivatives market in the world. This is all about asserting yourself top dog against rivals. Where are the rivals? In Europe. Eurex, another very large derivatives exchange, formed from an earlier merger of the German derivatives exchange and the Swiss German exchange. So driven by competition. Just nice if you know, if you have some awareness of these changes in the last 20 to 25 years and how these changes are showing up. Now a piece of good news for you and a piece of bad news. I'll give you the good news first. As far as we are concerned in this module, there are only two types of financing: equity and debt. The truth is, it's more complicated than that. The truth is, there's quite a story to tell in between equity and debt. You'll come across the phrase hybrid securities. which have some of the properties of equity and some of the properties of debt. That's the job of subsequent finance modules to teach you. As far as we are concerned, there are only two classes, equity and debt. That's the good news. The bad news, we really do need to understand, not just know, but understand the key characteristics of equity and of debt. We need to know what are the key differences. I could ask you to list, to describe the key characteristics of equity versus debt, because that will also help us to understand why does the company raise finance in the form of equity or debt. So what is it I need you to know about equity? Now, some of this we've already met. We covered it in an earlier lecture, but in less detail. So what are the key characteristics of equity? Well, equity represents shareholding. So it's the shareholders who own the equity of the company. And a term that I've mentioned many times, which by now must be familiar to you, market capitalization, is the name we give to the market value, not the book value, the market value of the firm's equity. But the equity is only one part of the story, remember. The total value of the firm will be made up out of the value of its equity piece together with the value of its debt piece. Because the value of the firm as a whole is the value of its assets. And the assets are partly funded by equity and partly funded by debt. And we'll go on and look at that in more detail in the lectures on capital structure next week. So when I say equity, I'm talking about shareholders. What is it that the shareholders own? What are the key characteristics of that equity? One key characteristic is its limited liability. The worst that can happen to the shareholders is they lose all of their initial investment. If the company were to go bankrupt, belly up, then the shareholding is worth nothing. That's the bad news. The good news is there is no way that any of the company's creditors, so who might the creditors be? The lenders, who want the interest payments on their loans, the taxman, who wants the company's corporation taxes paid, the suppliers who've provided raw materials, etc., and want paid, so those would be trade creditors. Any number of creditors can pursue the company for money outstanding through the courts, but not the shareholders. They can't take the shareholders to court. They can ask the administrators to use whatever the company has in the way of assets, sell off some of its assets, to raise money to pay some of the liabilities, but there's no way they can pursue the shareholders for additional money through the courts. So in that sense, the shareholders have limited liability. The shareholders have voting rights. Now, those voting rights are typically used to decide on the membership of the main board. It's the shareholders who own the equity of the company. But it's not the shareholders who make the day-to-day decisions of the company. The shareholders have delegated that responsibility to the senior managers, the main board. So where is it that the shareholders have a voice? Their voice can be expressed either at the annual general meeting or possibly an extraordinary general meeting. Their voices can be heard if they object to the continuing membership of the main board. They have a considerable say in who replaces whom on the main board when the first person's time is up for renewal. It's at meetings of the annual general meetings or extraordinary general meetings that the shareholders, provided enough of them get together and cast their vote the same way, they can force the company to change its decision. But on a day-to-day basis, the shareholders have delegated that decision-making to the senior managers. But nonetheless, the shareholders have rights. They have voting rights. So in return for putting up the money in the first place to buy the shares, the shareholders are acquiring some measure of control. Now, it's arm's-length financing. They're standing back from the day-to-day running of the company. That's the way in which the company is typically governed here in the UK and in the US. We've already seen, but I need to remind you, of the residual claim, the nature, the residual nature of the claim that the shareholders have on the company's funds. Think back to that queue that I've mentioned to you before. When the company has surplus funds, the first call on those funds are the interest payments that are owed to the lenders. Woe betide any company that misses an interest payment. It can be wound up in the courts. Interest payments are legally enforceable. Likewise, paying back the loan when the loan matures. So first call on the company's cash flows are from its lenders. They're at the head of the queue. Next in line for handouts is the taxman. The shareholders are at the back of the queue. And it's in that sense that their claim on the company's cash flows is a residual one. Now, in the good times, everybody's happy because there's plenty to go around. There's plenty of cash flow swimming around to draw upon to keep meeting the interest payments, to pay back any loans that have matured, to pay the corporation tax bill, and if it's the company's policy to do so, to distribute to the shareholders a nice, tidy dividend. The differences start to show up when the company's not doing so well, when the cash flows are scarce, there's limited cash flow. First and foremost, the debt holders must be fed. They've got to be completely satisfied. Likewise, the taxman. I'm afraid if there isn't enough money to go around, by the time we've reached the shareholders, they have to do without. Now, the company, as we'll discover in a couple of weeks' time, the company will typically want to operate a stable dividend policy. It won't want to cut the dividend it pays per share, but as times get particularly difficult, it may have no option. And the company that I spent most of my own working life with, BP, has had to face this now twice in my lifetime. When I worked for them in the early 90s, 1992, they had to cut their dividend per share by a factor of two. And that didn't half send a very negative signal to the market. And again, through the problems they experienced in the Gulf of Mexico in May of last year, no dividend payments. We need to hold on to all of the cash we've got because we're facing potentially very large tens of billions of dollars legal fees, legal bills, paying for damages, etc., to the environment. So if times are tough, it's the shareholders who lose out. The company may have to reduce its dividend per share. It may even have to stop paying a dividend for a period of time. So the shareholders' claim on the company's cash flows is a residual claim. That's another key characteristic of equity. And as hopefully you're beginning to realise, I mentioned it in, I think, the second lecture. We're going to be saying more about it as the weeks go by, gradually dropping it into the conversation. Why do individuals or institutions put up the money in the first place to buy shares in a company? Because they're chasing returns. They're after a rate of return on their investment that's better than something else they could do with their money. When the context is equity investment, that return comes in two forms. Dividends, and that represents income, and share price appreciation, that's capital gains. So shareholders generally are in the story for returns, and the returns can take two forms. Income, namely through the payment of dividends, and capital gains through price appreciation. So those are the key characteristics that I want you to know about equity. I don't just want you to memorise them, I want you to have some understanding. So you should be able to say back to yourself a sentence or two that explains to your satisfaction what each of the bullet points means. Now let's flip over to debt. And we can say a bit more about debt, because in some senses the debt story is richer. Whenever I think of debt, I see a cash flow diagram in my head. Now you may not want to think that way, that's fine. But the cash flow diagram I see in my head has, at regular intervals out into the future, the coupon interest payments that the borrower must pay to the lender, culminating at the end of the loan's life by the repayment, now this is important, the repayment of the face value of the loan. That's the cash flow diagram I have in mind. In terms of the cash flows that point upwards and that represent the cash flows that the borrower returns to the lender. Today, if this is when the loan is created, this is when the loan is initially issued, there is a downward pointing arrow from the point of view of the lender. Of course, it's an upward pointing arrow from the point of view of the borrower. So that's what's raised today if this is when the loan is created. If I now move forward in time, so the loan has already been in existence for some time, think of it as a bond, so think of this as debt financing that's raised through the debt capital markets in the form of a bond. Now what I can think about is the bond changing hands. The bond is tradable. We can buy and sell such bonds. So now if I look at my cash flow diagram today, I can think of what it looks like from the point of view of the trade today. Whoever previously owned the bond is now selling the bond onto someone else. The new owner, whoever is buying the bond today, they pay the market value for the bond. Not the face value of the loan, the market value. The face value was what was involved when the loan was first issued. But as time passes, and the bond can be bought or sold, and of course the financial environment changes, market conditions change, the bond's market value, the bond's second-hand market value changes. When the loan was initially issued, we're in the primary market. And typically the sum of money that's exchanged is the face value of the bond. The market value and the face value are commonly the same. We say the bond has been issued or struck at par, P-A-R. That's the story in the primary market at the beginning of the bond's life. Subsequently, during the bond's remaining lifetime, it can be bought and sold in the secondary market. And the money that changes hands then is the market value of the bond. Could be greater than the face value, could be less than the face value. If the market value is greater than the face value, we might talk about the bond trading at a premium to par, face or par value. If the market value is less than the face value, you've guessed it, we talk about the bond trading at a discount to par or face value. My cash flow diagram now, as measured from today, represents a cash flow, whatever sum of money is exchanged today between the buyer and the seller, that's the market value of the bond, and thereafter the remainder of the diagram has those remaining coupon interest payments together with the return of face value at the end of the bond's life. Now in the simplest cases, and these are the only ones we'll worry about in this module, in the simplest cases, the coupon interest is fixed. It's a fixed percentage, this is important, it's a fixed percentage of the face value, not the market value. The face value, which is written on the bond certificate and was agreed up front when the bond was first issued. So in the simplest cases, what's typically referred to as plain vanilla bonds, in the simplest cases, the size of the interest payments is fixed. But it needn't be. There are other types of bond where the size of the interest payment can go up and down depending on what is happening in the world of interest rates. So one distinction that we can draw in the real world is between fixed rate loans and floating rate loans. What do they have in common? The formula for deciding the size of the interest payment is fixed at the beginning of the bond's life. Now, the only bonds we'll consider are bonds where the formula says interest payment equals a fixed number. But it doesn't have to be a fixed number. It's the formula that's fixed at the outset. And that formula might say the interest payments are a certain amount, a spread, above some market reference rate, such as LIBOR, the London Interbank Offered Rate. In other words, the rate at which the big banks lend or borrow money from each other. So our company that is borrowing money has to pay a higher interest rate. How much extra does it have to pay? That's fixed up front. That's a spread or a premium on top of the LIBOR rate. And the LIBOR rate itself goes up and down with changes in market conditions. Money market conditions. So I don't want you to think that all bonds pay fixed coupons. What all bonds have in common is there's a formula agreed at the beginning of the bond's life that's fixed. That doesn't change. Debt can be secured or unsecured. And that's reflected in the size of the interest payment. Secured debt is where the lender has some form of assurance that if the company starts to struggle, it can be forced to sell off some of its assets in order to raise sufficient cash to keep meeting the interest payments. So the loan is secured against the fixed assets of the company. You might not be surprised to learn then that secured loans pay lower interest payments. They're less risky from the point of view of the lender. Unsecured loans typically pay higher interest payments. Senior versus junior. I've told you that in the queue for cash handouts, the lenders are at the head of the queue. Then the tax man, then the shareholders. Actually, not all lenders are equal in the eyes of God. The senior debt holders, they're at the very top of the queue, the very head of the queue. Then the subordinated or junior debt holders. So not all lenders are equal in terms of the pecking order for cash handouts. There are other features called callable and convertible bonds. The good news, you don't need to know what they are for this module. You'll find out in Finance 1 next year. And we've already met foreign bonds and euro bonds. Foreign bonds are bonds that are issued by a foreign institution. Euro bonds are bonds that are traded in some jurisdiction different from the currency in which the cash flows are denominated. I'll tell you more tomorrow.